come up with an alternative. She had to trust that Bobby knew what he was doing.
Fine, then let's do this.
His smile grew broader. Who knew you were this easy?
Shut up!
Bobby used his studio keycard to unlock the door and enter the special effects studio. She followed him up to a workroom on the second floor. It was full of computer equipment, giant plasma monitors, and a neighboring green screen studio.
Do you know how to run all this?
Bobby gave her a how stupid do I look glare.
Who grew up on Xbox and could hand-build his own computer from the age of 9?
Besides, as an intern, I spent a few weeks here slinging coffee and donuts for the post-production crew. I learned everything I could. You'd be surprised what doors a double whip mocha latte will open for you here.
She turned in a circle. What do I have to do?
First, you'll need a new outfit.
He pointed to a row of black spandex suits hanging on a row of pegs. The bodysuits had ping pong balls glued all over them.
You can change behind that curtain.
She took a deep breath, grabbed the smallest of the suits, and retreated behind the curtain. She quickly stripped to her bra and panties and shimmied into the tight outfit. Once done, she stared down at her body. The spandex clung like a second skin. She felt naked and stupid. White ping pong balls marked each joint and curve of her body.
What's taking you so long? Bobby called to her. I'm all set here.
She stepped from behind the curtain and pointed to him.
Not a word.
His mouth dropped open at the sight of her. He lifted a finger to his chin and closed his mouth, but his grin remained and spoke volumes. He crossed to her and handed her a pair of goggles that looked like a large black scuba mask. The goggles trailed a set of black cords.
What now? She asked.
He pointed to the neighboring studio, wrapped all in green.
The motion capture suit works best against a green screen. Put on the goggles and you'll see everything I do on the computer.
Bobby walked her into the empty studio and helped her put on the heavy goggles. The inside of the mask was one big digital screen. A computerized test pattern filled her vision.
Okay, he said. Just stand there until I say go.
Then what?
Do what you do best. I'll run the controls while you just paint.
She heard him plug in the goggles' cords, then retreat out of the studio. The door closed. She felt suddenly alone. Over the years, she had developed a suspicion of technology, going back to the machines that had failed to keep her mother alive. She had turned instead to what her mother loved. The simplicity of oil on canvas, of spray paint on walls. That was magic enough for her. She had no use for the cold, calculating world of computer technology. That was Bobby's domain. She had to trust him. Did trust him. Bobby's voice reached her through tiny speakers built into the goggles.
Sue, wave your arms for me. I want to make sure the computer is properly capturing your motion.
She obeyed, feeling silly.
That's it! Perfect calibration! I'm activating you now.
The test pattern in her goggles dissolved away, and she found herself staring into a new world. It appeared as if she were standing in front of an easel in the middle of a meadow brimming with wildflowers. Butterflies fluttered among the blossoms while birds spun and twittered. She raised an arm to block out the sunlight, only it wasn't her arm that rose in front of her, but a computer-generated facsimile.
Is it too bright?
Bobby's voice whispered from tiny speakers in the goggles.
It's hard to judge from the monitor.
Yes, a little too much glare.
I'll adjust.
Su Ling squinted into the meadow. The sun suddenly sank toward the horizon, shadows stretching.
How's that?
He asked.
Much better, she said. But what do I do now?
Paint your tag, Sue. That attracted the beast before. Call him into the virtual world. I'll record from here.
Steeling herself, she inhaled sharply and reached for the paintbrush and palette of oils. Though nothing was truly in front of her, the motion and response was so perfect that it made her feel like it was. She swore she could almost feel the brush in one hand and the palette in the other. After a few fumbling attempts, she fell into her usual rhythm. She dabbed her brush into the oil and tentatively drew her first stroke, a slash of crimson on the white canvas. The remaining 13 strokes completed her characteristic tag in a few breaths. Clutching her virtual paintbrush, she waited. Nothing happened.
Bobby?
Did you paint it correctly, Sue?
She studied her work. It was perfect.
What am I forgetting?
Then it dawned on her. She reached a finger through empty air, while in another world, a computer-generated finger rose and reached for the center of the painted glyph on the canvas. As contact was made, a familiar tingling surged up her arm. Su Ling tensed, holding her breath. She waited for several heartbeats. Still nothing. She started to drop her arm when a stabbing cold seized her wrist. She wanted desperately to pull away like before, but she knew this time she must stand firm, hold fast, not disgrace the family as her ancestor had done so many centuries ago. Foreign memories suddenly flooded into her consciousness, like dreams long forgotten, slipping back into focus again. She remembered Shandong Province with the sun rising over the Yellow Sea. She remembered fishing with her brothers, cherry blossoms floating on the water. She remembered her first love, Wan Li, turning his back on her after her shame.
Sue!
Bobby had an uncertain edge to his voice.
What are you doing? There's this old woman dressed in a robe on the screen where you're supposed to be.
Su Ling barely heard him, floating between past and present. She began to understand as more ancestral memories filled her.
She's a friend, she finally mumbled, knowing it to be true. I don't know quite what's happening, but your hunch was right. It's coming. I sense it. Like electricity before a thunderstorm.
The cold crept up her arm, seeking her heart. Dusty laughter, old and cracked, followed and crumbled into words.
I have found you at long last, Siu Fa, my little flower.
Distant memories intruded. A foggy glen surrounded by towering trees, the lowing of cattle from a distant rice paddy, and a creature of nightmares crouching, its voice mocking. Su Ling's lips moved, but she did not know who spoke, herself or her ancestor.
Giu Su.
More dark laughter.
Ah, you know my name. You have hidden well over the years, Siu Fa. But now it is time to be plucked. I shall wear you as an ornament once I am free, free to stalk the world of man.
A mist rose from the meadow floor and coalesced into an ancient face, yellow and wrinkled like a dried apricot. The face split into a leer, lined by fangs. The fog continued to encircle her, forming the coils of a snake, along with a reptilian claw that gripped her wrist. Old fears arose, like smoke from an extinguished fire.
Trapped! Must escape! Flee!
Her head throbbed, and the world began to tilt, eyes blurring.
Su Ling!
Bobby's voice jolted her to the present.
I can see that monster on the monitor! Get out of there!
The spiked and scaled body of the beast appeared in the mist. She began to yank her arm away when a foreign thought intruded.
No, stand firm, child. You must resist.
Sue, I'm ending the program.
No, Bobby,
she yelled. Understanding dawned in her.
The circle isn't complete. It will follow me out.
Let it try, Bobby said. I'll take care of it.
His words, full of bravura and love, conjured more recent memories. Running the back alleys with Bobby, fleeing police and gang members, laughing, planting tags throughout the city.
My city. Our city. Just do as we planned, she said. Complete the circle.
The Giu Su leaned closer, suspicious, its breath stale as an open grave.
Who do you speak to, little one? Prayers, perhaps? Do not bother seeking aid from your puny gods. Prayers will not save you.
Who needs prayers when you've got friends who love you?
And she knew it to be true.
Now, Bobby!
Engaging copies!
The empty meadow suddenly filled with 34 other easels, exact copies of her original. They encircled the field. Disembodied arms, floating free, repeated what she had painted earlier. 34 arms picked up brushes and palettes and painted identical symbols in unison. Then they all reached forward to touch the center of their glyphs. A flash of confusion swept over the creature's jaundiced features. Its fiery eyes darted everywhere. The claws gripping her hand faded back to mist. Snaking coils dissolved back to fog. The mocking face leaned close.
"What trick is this, witch?"
She knew the answer. A spell broken long ago is woven again.
"Impossible. There are no other guardians. What trickery is this?"
The Gyu-su collected its mists like a woman gathering her skirts and glided across the meadow. It tried to break out of the circle, but was stopped by an invisible wall of force. It flattened its mists against the barrier, probing for an opening. With a shriek, it thrashed back and forth across the meadow, flinging itself against the sides of its new prison. After a full minute, it stopped and rushed at her.
"Drop your arms, Yufar. Break the circle and I will let you escape again."
Same old trick. "Not this century," she sneered.
"You'll never be able to stand there forever,"
it warned, rearing up in threat and fury.
"You'll tire. Then I will devour you."
She faced the monster with an arched eyebrow. "Really? Then let me welcome you to the new millennium. You're nothing but a ghost of the past, and the past is where you will remain, locked forever in memory." She called more loudly. "Bobby, hit it!"
"Saving to disk now."
The world within the goggles pulled away, shrinking smaller and smaller until the digital window was the size of a postage stamp. As it receded, she saw them appear, standing behind each of the other easels. Different Chinese women of varying ages, the murdered provincial guardians from the ancient past. They bowed to her, acknowledging an ancient debt paid in full. At the last moment, a whisper reached her, full of love and pride.
"Si Lo Chai."
She knew that voice, those tender words. Tears welled, bursting from her swollen heart.
"Mother."
A warmth filled her as the tenuous connection faded. Su Ling struggled to hold it, but it was like grasping smoke. The connection ended, as it must. That was not her world. Still, the warmth remained inside her. The true ghost of her mother. Her everlasting love. The image of a computer desktop snapped into place inside her goggles. It held frozen the last picture. 35 guardians encircling a demon. Then that file dropped away into a computerized folder icon. A symbol of a combination lock overlay the folder. It clicked closed.
"We're locked up,"
Bobby called out. Su Ling took a long, shuddering breath, then pulled off her goggles. She stood again in the empty studio. Behind her, the door banged open, and Bobby rushed inside. His expression grew concerned as he saw her face.
"Su, are you all right?"
She wiped her tears.
"Never better."
And she meant it. Bobby crossed to her and handed her a recordable DVD. A thin crust of frost caked its surface.
"It should be trapped in there, right?"
She nodded and took the DVD. "I hope so."
"So then we've won,"
Bobby said, blowing out his relief. "The battle, perhaps, but not the war." She knew the Gyu-su was only a small part of the Chaos Lord. There was still a wall in Riverside that needed her handiwork, or come dawn, Los Angeles would really rock and roll. Bobby stood before her.
"What now?"
"Time to go to work. Do you have a can of spray paint?" He raised his eyebrows as if insulted.
"Of course."
She leaned and tipped up on her toes again. This time she kissed his lips. "Then let's go save the world."
Raygun by Tim Malini. Read by Kevin T. Collins.
When you're 16, you often dream of being a hero, but rarely do you actually get to save the world. Ray just hoped he was up for the task. His full name was Raymond Gunstein, but friends called him Ray, and his dad called him Ray Gunn, which he kind of liked. If he really were a hero, a superhero with a badass costume and everything, that's what he'd want to be called. But right at this moment, hanging from the roof of a speeding train, he had bigger problems than choosing a nickname. Ray tightened his grip and watched as blood ran down his leg, over his ankle, then vanished in the rushing wind. The train was moving at over 100 miles an hour, so no matter how much he bled, not a single drop would hit the tracks below. And if he lost his grip, they could scrape a mile of track and still not find enough DNA to identify the body. It was a new high-speed rail, much faster than the Amtrak commuter train that used to run from New York to Washington. Each car had a door at both ends. Signs all over the train advised passengers to hold on carefully when moving between cars, and a white placard with red letters warned that climbing ladders to the roof of the train was strictly prohibited while the train was in motion, even for railroad employees. Ray's mom was a lawyer, so he knew what prohibited meant. It meant only an idiot would climb onto the roof of a speeding train. I must be an idiot, thought Ray, hanging on to the narrow railing that ran along the roof of the dining car. Ray took a deep breath and tensed his muscles, hoping he had enough strength to climb to the top of the train. It all started with a lost lizard. Ray had been sitting in his compartment across from his dad. They'd left the door open so it wouldn't feel too cramped, and the corridor was empty. Not that Ray's dad would have noticed, his head barely visible above the screen of his laptop. That's bad for your eyes, Dad.
Mm-hmm.
Ray's dad was named Phil, and he was a scientist, which apparently involved being absent-minded. So Ray already knew what his dad was going to say.
Forgot my reading glasses. Bet they're on my desk at home.
Ray yawned and took out his iPhone.
Wanna play chess?
Phil Gunstein looked up from the screen and smiled.
I'd love to, later, but right now I have to run some numbers.
Ray was on spring break, traveling with his dad to a scientific conference in D.C., His mom was back in New York, preparing for an important case coming to trial. Something to do with a big energy company, accusations of fraud, and a senator who just got indicted. Unlike a lot of his friends, Ray got along well with his parents, but these days it seemed like they were married to their work instead of to each other. His dad squinted at the screen.
It looks like the phase induction is a lot bigger than I projected. Could be a problem.
At any given time, Ray liked to think he understood about half of what his dad was talking about. This wasn't one of those times.
Does your, phasing problem have anything to do with your presentation at the conference?
Ray thought he sounded less clueless than he felt. His dad scratched his head with both hands, a sign he was struggling to make a complicated idea sound simple.
You know all the buzz about alternative fuels?
Ray nodded. His school had been on a green crusade for some time, recycling, composting, homework sent by email to save paper.
Wind power, solar, renewable energy.
Solar, sure. Or something entirely new.
His dad raised his eyebrows dramatically.
Think Starship Enterprise.
Antimatter?
Ray leaned forward. His dad had DVD box sets for every season of Star Trek and The Next Generation. The entire family had been hooked since Ray was a kid.
You're not serious.
His dad nodded.
That's why I've spent so much time at CERN.
Thanks to Google, Ray had seen countless pictures of CERN, so although he'd never been there, he visualized the underground complex as soon as his dad said the name. The home of the world's largest particle accelerator, built at the border of Switzerland and France. A racetrack 10 miles in diameter, powered by electromagnets, where physicists sent subatomic particles racing close to the speed of light, smashing them together to see what might happen. CERN was a demolition derby for atoms.
We discovered a simple way to create antimatter.
Phil Gunstein frowned.
But some people aren't happy about it.
Like?
Some of the energy companies still heavily vested in oil, or those who want to control the discovery for themselves, and a few skeptics who think we might accidentally create a black hole that would eat the planet.
He said black hole nonchalantly, as if discussing the weather, but the idea grabbed Ray's imagination in a chokehold.
Will you?
Ray visualized a black ball with red eyes and sharp teeth gnawing its way through the planet like a worm through an apple.
Not a chance.
Phil Gunstein looked suddenly impatient, like he'd been forced to defend his theories for too long.
That's just a dumb idea started by people who never studied science. Unfortunately, most politicians fall into that category. That's why we're holding this press conference, to share our discovery with the world.
Ray already knew who his dad meant by we, the four other physicists on his team, 2 men and 2 women, meeting them in Washington later that day.
See for yourself.
Phil winked, then rummaged around a small suitcase until he found a metal canister. It looked like a stainless steel thermos. There was a clear band running around the middle of the container, a translucent window into the device. Holding the object tightly at either end, Phil Gunstein twisted his hands in opposing directions and said,
"Let there be light."
Ray felt the hairs on his arms stand up, and suddenly the cabin filled with a brilliant blue-green light. The center of the canister was glowing like a miniature sun. Ray looked away until his dad twisted the 2 ends back to their original position. A tickling sensation ran down his spine, then everything returned to normal. Ray tried to blink away the spots in his eyes.
Cool.
He didn't know what else to say, and he did think his dad's work was cool, even though he sometimes wished his dad would get as excited about his life as he did about his life's work.
Thought you'd get a kick out of that.
His dad held the thermos like a trophy.
The antimatter in this container could power an electric car for 10 years.
And it's safe? Ray trusted his dad implicitly, but the image of a hungry black hole had made an impression.
Perfectly safe, unless you believe in string theory, but most physicists have moved on.
His dad looked almost embarrassed.
The stuff of science fiction, not science fact.
Tell me. His dad made a dismissive gesture but kept talking. Ray knew once you got Phil Gunstein talking about his work, the real trick was getting him to shut up.
Some people think there are other dimensions, other worlds.
He spread the fingers of his right hand and waved them in front of Ray's eyes.
Places where people like us might be moving around, right here, in the spaces in between things.
He closed his fingers into a fist one by one.
Harness this kind of energy, then, theoretically, you could open a doorway.
And the people there could reach over here? Ray shifted in his seat and pocketed the iPhone, neglected on his lap. This was getting interesting.
Nobody knows.
His dad made a face.
That's one of the problems with string theory. Some think only energy could pass through, but if matter and energy are the same, why not something solid? It would be like moving from 2 dimensions to 3, or from 3 to 4, why not 5 or 6? But even fringe scientists admit no living creature could survive the journey.
His voice trailed off as he shook his head at his own foolishness. But what if something could come across?
Something, as opposed to someone? Maybe a weapon, Ray shrugged, or psychic energy, or a message. Maybe aliens, his dad smiled. You've been reading too many comic books.
They're graphic novels, said Ray, his turn to sound impatient. That's when they heard the scream. It was a high-pitched yell followed by a curse which preceded a blur that transformed into a girl in a hurry. She dashed into the corridor as Ray jumped to his feet and almost slammed into her.
Have you seen my gecko?
The girl didn't miss a beat, just looked frantically past Ray down at the floor, searching. She was Ray's age, give or take, with reddish hair and eyes that looked brown under the fluorescent lights. She was cute. More than cute, actually. She waved a hand in front of his eyes, then snapped her fingers, and Ray realized he was staring.
A gecko? Hello?
Sorry, no. Ray shrugged apologetically. It's a lizard, a little green lizard, said the girl. Name's Greenie. Ray held out his hand. Ray.
My gecko's name is Greenie.
She smiled and took a breath, as if really noticing Ray for the first time. My name is Amanda. Her eyes radiated warmth as they locked on his face. When she blinked, the connection was broken, and Ray felt a pang of regret. His last girlfriend was a distant memory.
Sorry about your lizard.
Not your fault. Amanda looked back toward the neighboring compartment. I'm traveling with my aunt. Aunt Edith, and she... Amanda took a step closer and lowered her voice.
Has a dog.
She made it sound like her aunt's dog ownership was a source of great embarrassment.
I always wanted a dog, said Ray, loud enough for his dad to hear, though it wouldn't be the first time he'd heard it.
This isn't a real dog, said Amanda dismissively. It's alive, of course. But it's a lap dog, one of those yappy little things. Do you know why lap dogs were bred back in Europe during the late 1600s?
Ray shook his head.
To attract fleas.
Amanda nodded.
It's true. People didn't have running water, and they didn't bathe much. She wrinkled her nose. So the idea was that if you had a lap dog, the fleas would jump off you.
She reached forward and pressed a finger against Ray's chest.
And onto your dog.
Did it work?
Got me, Amanda shrugged. But that dog is a menace.
How come?
Because lizards are afraid of dogs.
Amanda puffed out her cheeks.
Guess I should have thought of that before letting Greenie out of his box.
She scanned the corridor again.
I think he ran toward the dining car.
Let's go look.
Aren't you the gentleman?
Amanda gave Ray an appraising glance. He felt himself starting to blush, so he looked over his shoulder.
Dad, I'm going for a walk.
His dad waved absently, his head already hidden behind his laptop. The train rocked back and forth as they moved toward the next car. Ray scanned the carpet, but the light in the corridor was dim. The doors to the other compartments were all closed. No geckos. They came to the end of the car, a sliding door with a round window.
You been in there?
Amanda jutted her chin toward the door. Ray shook his head.
Not yet.
Dining car. Amanda smacked her lips.
Let's go.
What about Greenie? Amanda looked down at the floor, along the walls, up at the ceiling.
He's run away before, but always comes back.
She sighed. Truth is, I usually don't find him until he finds me. With a hard pull, she yanked open the sliding door. Fresh air and train noises washed over them. Instead of the clack-clack-clack of older trains, the wheels hummed, almost at a subsonic level. Ray could feel the vibrations through the soles of his shoes. Carefully, they stepped between cars. With another pull, they found themselves in the dining car.
Ray heard a rumbling and realized it was his stomach. His dad always forgot to eat once absorbed in his work, and Ray had lost track of time. Lunch had come and gone, but the dining car never closed. Along the right side of the car, small tables were covered with cold cuts, bread, condiments, enough food to stop a famine. "This is sick," said Ray, building himself a sandwich.
"Na-na-na."
Amanda smiled broadly, her mouth already full. She had moved left, where a long table covered by a white tablecloth held the desserts, chocolate balls stacked in pyramids like cannonballs on a pirate ship, a chocolate cake carved into triangle slices, the whole thing bigger than a large pizza, enough cookies to crush a whole troop of Girl Scouts. "Sorry?" Amanda swallowed whatever she was eating in one huge gulp. "I said, not bad, huh?" Ray smiled and looked across the tables. "Not bad at all." The afternoon train was half empty, most commuters preferring the morning express, so they had the car to themselves. But 10 minutes later, Ray had to get out of there. His stomach was bulging and an ache was on its way. An all-you-can-eat buffet and a 16-year-old male was a dangerous combination under any circumstances. Amanda nodded her agreement when he said, "Let's go find your lizard." Dizzy from the sugar rush, they lurched across the connecting platform into their car and almost collided with a man standing just on the other side of the sliding door. "Oops!" Amanda was first through the door. "Excuse me." The man said nothing. He was tall, much taller than Ray, and his skin had an unhealthy pallor. He wore a baggy suit, white shirt, and gray tie, and in his right hand he held a stainless steel briefcase. His eyes were concealed by a pair of mirrored sunglasses. Ray could see his own reflection in the lenses. He started to step aside to let the man pass, but for the second time that day, Amanda's scream locked his feet to the floor. In the confined space, the noise startled both Ray and the stranger, who stumbled backward and dropped his briefcase. Ray instinctively bent down and grabbed it, ready to apologize, thinking, Amanda must have seen her gecko, that's why she screamed. But as he leaned forward, Ray caught her expression and looked more closely at the man in the sunglasses. "Amanda?" he said in a voice he didn't recognize as his own. "Run! Now!" The sunglasses now sat askew on the man's face, exposing one eye, an eye unlike any Ray had ever seen, deep yellow, with a vertical slit for a pupil, the kind of eye you'd find on a cat or a snake, not a human being. The stranger blinked, and an eyelid the color of sour milk slid sideways. Then he reached for his briefcase. Ray gazed at the man's hand, the skin of his forearm as the jacket pulled back. Skin that had looked jaundiced in the weak light was, up close, really a dull green. This wasn't a man at all. Amanda was on the balls of her feet, standing to the man's left. Ray was on the right, still holding the briefcase. He couldn't chase them both. Ray made a decision. Taking a step backward, he pulled open the door that separated the cars. From the corner of his eye, Ray sensed the man reaching, a peripheral vision of a moss-colored hand and yellow eye, but Ray was already gone, leaping across the platform into the dining car. He sprinted the length of the car and didn't look over his shoulder until he reached the far end. The good news was the stranger hadn't chased Amanda. The bad news was that he was chasing Ray. Chasing wasn't exactly the right word, because the man walked as if he had all the time in the world. His movements were deliberate, the legs stiff, his knees not bending the way they should. Step by painful step, he advanced, as inexorable as the tide, as relentless as the monsters that hide under your bed. The sunglasses were back in place, and for an instant Ray tried to convince himself it had all been his imagination. A full stomach, a pretty girl, a trick of the light. But any hopes were shattered when the man opened his mouth and his face tore itself in half. The jaw wasn't hinged like a human mouth, but was set farther back, so the top half of his head swung open like the tailgate of a truck, exposing row upon row of conical teeth. They glinted in the diffuse light of the car, each a white spear dripping with saliva. Ray didn't need a written invitation. He turned around and yanked the door handle with all his strength and lurched forward, only to smash his face against the glass. The door was locked. Ray jerked the handle again, peered across the platform at the next car. Where is the conductor? He banged on the window but nearly broke his hand, his fist making a dull thud against the thick glass. Did the creature come from this side of the train and then lock the door? Is there anyone in the next compartment, or are they all dead? Either way, Ray was trapped. He felt the blood drain from his face as he turned to his captor, wondering if the man would be standing right behind him. The man wasn't standing at all. In the brief time Ray had turned his back, the creature, Ray couldn't think of a better word for it, had clearly decided it would be easier to climb the walls than learn how to walk on 2 feet. It still came slowly, but its movements were more confident. Fingers spread, it moved along the wall like a spider, legs splayed as it crawled forward. Ray considered dropping the briefcase, making a mad dash for the exit, but the car was too narrow. He was stuck unless the creature decided to let him go. Yeah, right. Ray scanned the long tables, searching for something he could use as a weapon. Plastic forks and knives, white bread and cold cuts, chocolate balls. Not a steak knife in sight. His gaze shifted to the windows, where a frantic blur of trees and telephone poles passed by. The windows. The creature flexed its jaw as it crept closer, exposing a forked tongue that squirmed like an angry worm. Ray started moving before a plan even formed in his mind. He took off his belt. Quickly, he looped it through the handle of the briefcase, then slung it over his shoulder, wearing the case like a messenger bag. And before the creature closed the gap between them another foot, Ray was opening the nearest window. The rush of air almost knocked him backward, and it took all his strength to lean outside. He held his breath and pushed, squeezing his upper body through the top half of the window, twisting as he dragged the bag behind him. A small ledge ran across the top of the window to deflect rain or any debris, and Ray could just reach it if he stretched. His eyes started to water, and the reflection off the glass made it almost impossible to see clearly into the car. But Ray knew he didn't have much time. He pulled his left leg outside and pressed it against the window ledge. Then he felt a damp cold wrap itself around his right ankle and almost lost his grip. As he pressed his face against the window, his worst fear was confirmed. The creature's jaw had unhinged, the forked tongue tickling Ray's calf as the head slid forward. Its rubbery hand was holding his right leg like a drumstick. Ray gripped the railing in both hands and twisted sideways, swinging his left foot through the open window and catching the creature on the chin. The jaw snapped back, bottom teeth tearing across Ray's calf like broken glass. A searing pain followed by a release of pressure as the creature loosened its grip. Palm sweating, Ray kicked frantically against the side of the train, trying to boost himself up. His right leg was on fire, a river of blood soaking through his pants. The rushing air was blinding. Now that they were away from the city, the train seemed to be moving even faster. The track below was an angry blur. Ray thought he might pass out. Pull! He got an elbow over the railing but slipped. Ray cried out as his body floated away from the train, gravity failing, until he realized they must have hit a turn. He adjusted his grip, one hand at a time, and tried to swing his legs sideways. That's when he saw a green hand claw its way through the window. It swept to the right, searching blindly. Ray gritted his teeth and swung to the left. His leg hooked the railing, and he rolled onto the roof of the train, facing back the way he had come, toward his compartment and his dad. But it was a long car. Hand locked around the railing, he slowly inched his way forward across the roof, wiggling back and forth on his belly, his face grazing the roof of the train. He felt the cool metal against his forehead and fought the urge to stop and close his eyes. Ray was almost at the front of the car, near the ladder, just another 3 feet. He could feel the weight of the briefcase, the strap biting into his shoulder. He felt weak and wasn't sure he could climb the ladder between the cars. He took a deep breath and risked a glance backward, his eyes following the red trail of his own blood. The creature was following the same trail from the other direction. The wind didn't seem to bother it. It lay perfectly still, eyes unfocused, until the impossible tongue emerged between stalagmites of teeth to sample Ray's blood. Then its head pivoted toward Ray as the yellow eyes narrowed. It might be nearsighted, but it had found the scent. "Come on, Ray. You can do this." Ray tore his gaze away from the creature and gasped. They had rounded a bend, and straight ahead was the gaping mouth of a tunnel. The front of the train had already disappeared inside. Ray didn't know how much clearance there was between the train and the ceiling of the tunnel, but it wasn't much. He only had seconds left. "You have to do this." Ray lurched sideways and spun so his legs dangled between the cars. His right foot found the ladder first, and he grimaced at the pain. Fingers numb, one rung at a time till he hit the platform, hard. Blackness. There was a heavy thunk overhead, followed by a rolling, tumbling sound. Then the roar of the tunnel filled Ray's ears until he was deaf. Heart beating like a jackhammer, Ray groped in the darkness until he found the door handle and pulled with all the strength he had left. "Lock that door!" Ray's father caught him as he fell across the threshold. The conductor stepped forward and turned a key into a square hole at the side of the metal door, then tested the handle. "Nobody's coming through there." The conductor was a stout man with a walrus mustache, and he looked angry. "I don't know what is going on with this train, but I intend to find out. Some businessman in first class claims somebody stole one of his suits, and the woman in the compartment next to him says her briefcase is missing. And now you folks claim..." "My God, son, what happened to your leg?"
"He fell."
Ray's dad answered for him, his face grim. Ray held on to his dad like a drowning sailor and kept his mouth shut. The conductor stalked over to the bathroom and emerged a moment later with a first aid kit.
"Give me that."
Ray's dad took the red and white box and half carried his son back to the bathroom, where he expertly cleaned the wound. It hurt, but wasn't as deep as Ray had feared, just a series of ugly furrows carved across the back of his leg. He'd done worse on a mountain bike. Once his dad had wrapped the cuts tightly in gauze, Ray saw a red pattern emerge, but then slow and finally stop. No blood was soaking through. He'd have a scar, several in fact, but he wasn't going to bleed to death. The conductor poked his head through the door.
"I'd suggest you folks lock yourselves in your compartments till I return. I'm going to check on the other passengers. And remember, there's an emergency call button in every car."
Ray let his dad gently nudge him along the corridor. Amanda emerged from her compartment, smiling bravely, then ran forward and gave Ray a hug. His hands started shaking from the adrenaline crash. Ray's dad gave his son another squeeze and helped him sit. Then he lifted the belt from around Ray's shoulders and said, "This is a souvenir from your adventure?" Ray nodded.
"Okay, then. Let's take a look inside that briefcase."
Amanda and Ray sat next to each other, across from his dad. Unconsciously, she rested a hand on Ray's thigh, as if the danger had drawn them closer. He felt lightheaded and wondered if it was just the loss of blood. His dad popped the latches on the metallic case. The inside was empty of the usual things a briefcase would hold, no papers, pens, or folders, just 5 identical objects. They looked like crystals, long and narrow with angular surfaces, and trapped within each was a viscous solution, a green liquid that almost glowed.
"What are they?" asked Ray.
His dad didn't answer. Instead, he picked up the first crystalline vial and held it close to his face. They were still inside the tunnel, so their window was a gray-black blur, the only light coming from a single bulb set into the ceiling. Phil Gunstein almost dropped the object. Taking a deep breath, he steadied his grip and set the vial back inside the briefcase. He had a grave look on his face.
"Dad, what is it?"
His dad picked up the other vials and examined them one by one. Ray noticed for the first time that the bottom of each narrowed to a point, like a syringe.
"See for yourselves."
Ray's dad lifted the first crystal vial so they could see the reflections moving across its surface. Ray gasped. Inside the crystal was a perfect hologram of his father. Every detail of his face, right down to the crow's feet around his eyes. He raised the next one, and Ray recognized the face immediately, one of the women working with his father on the antimatter project. 5 vials for 5 scientists, each with a perfect image of the recipient. His father had been first in line.
"What does it mean?" asked Amanda. "I think these vials were meant to kill you?"
Ray blurted his worst fear. His dad squinted at the vials.
"Or make us forget."
He looked at his son and forced a smile.
"But thanks to you, Ray Gunn, they failed."
He paused and then added,
"Whoever or whatever they are."
"But won't they, it, try again?" His dad shook his head.
"I don't think so. Once we hold our press conference, they'll have no reason to come after the scientists."
He paused, drew a breath.
"I guess anything is possible. We opened a doorway by accident. They saw it first and slipped something into our world."
He shrugged.
"Maybe they're afraid of us."
"Afraid of us?" said Ray.
"Maybe they're afraid of what we'll do if we visit their world. After all, we haven't always done the best job with ours."
Ray visualized the creature on top of the train. It hadn't looked like it was afraid of anything.
"But if we opened the door," his dad continued, "we can keep it closed."
Ray looked up.
"But that means abandoning your life's work." "I won't give up, just change direction."
His dad forced a smile.
"Besides, I'm looking at my life's work."
He placed a hand on Ray's shoulder. Ray felt himself blush. He turned toward Amanda to see if she'd noticed.
"Ray Gunn," she said, "you're not serious."
Ray started to reply, but was blinded by a burst of sunshine as they emerged from the tunnel. Everyone blinked and glanced outside. Ray could see rolling fields with horses and cows, speeding past like an out-of-control carousel.
Amanda opened her mouth to make another remark, but Ray never heard her, because her voice was drowned out by 1,000 pieces of glass exploding into the car. The creature was still alive, and it was climbing through the broken window. It moved like a folding chair, knees bending in the wrong direction as they extended through the window frame. Ray's dad pulled them back toward the door. They could run to the next car, but they couldn't all climb onto the roof like Ray did, and he was too weak to try it again. The thing in the window wasn't going to stop. His dad stared in disbelief, but had enough presence of mind to push Ray closer to Amanda. Their eyes met, and Ray noticed for the first time that her eyes weren't brown at all, but were dark green. Green, like a gecko. That's when he got the idea, and Ray knew from her expression Amanda was already there with him. She held his gaze for another second before dashing to the next compartment. Amanda returned carrying a large plastic box with a wire mesh door. Ray could see a white furry ball with a wrinkled face, watery brown eyes. Amanda gingerly opened the door and made kissing noises as she produced the smallest dog Ray had ever seen. Amanda shielded the dog's eyes as she stepped across the compartment. Ray's dad was trying to position himself to shove the creature at just the right moment, but Ray knew the creature would be too strong. It had survived the tunnel, and a kick to the jaw had barely registered. It might not be graceful, but it was powerful. Ray figured they had less than 5 seconds before the creature got far enough inside that it would be impossible to force it out again. He started counting in his head. 1. Ray's dad reached into his bag and produced his antimatter gadget. "Maybe this will scare it," he said through gritted teeth. "Stand back." 2. Amanda ignored him and squeezed in close to the window. She still had her hand over the dog's eyes, but the wind blew fiercely into the cabin, and the dog was growling deep in its throat. 3. The creature's face became visible as it slid down from the roof. Its yellow eyes were glaring at them. 4. Ray's dad started to twist the 2 halves of the stainless steel container. 5. Amanda thrust the terrified dog through the open window. Amanda held on tightly as the dog barked furiously, clawing Amanda's arms in a frantic scramble to get back inside. She winced from the pain, but didn't let go. Ray watched as the creature's slit pupils narrowed in fear. Then a green light exploded in the cabin, and Ray couldn't see anything at all. Ray blinked the spots from his eyes and saw his dad leaning out the window. When he was satisfied the creature was gone, Phil Gunstein pulled his head inside and dropped the metal canister onto the table. "I thought I'd try to blind it," he nodded at Amanda. "But I think your dog scared it silly." He petted the dog, which was still trembling. Ray noticed deep scratches across Amanda's arms. "You okay?" Amanda nodded as she left the cabin. Moments later, she came back with a towel wrapped around her arms, but without the dog. Ray reached for the first aid kit, but Amanda suddenly pushed past him and dropped to her knees. "Greenie!" Amanda laughed as a tiny lizard ran up her left arm and over her head, hiding itself in her red hair. She giggled and plucked it free, stood up, then held it by the tail only inches from her nose. "No more running away, you hear me?" She looked at Ray. "Told you he'd find me." Greenie swung back and forth, upside down. Ray smiled until the tiny creature swiveled its head in his direction. The lizard blinked, and Ray gasped as he made eye contact with the gecko. He recognized those eyes. They had tracked him across the dining car, followed him across the roof of the train. He looked from the lizard to Amanda, who was staring at him once again, as if she'd read his mind. Ray felt the hairs on the back of his neck stand up and wondered if it was only a side effect of his father's invention. He blinked, but where he saw spots only moments before, now he saw only coincidences. Ray glanced over at his dad, who was watching him and Amanda with a bemused expression, trying to connect the dots. Amanda still held the gecko only inches from his face. Ray forced a smile and said the first thing that came to mind. "Hey, Dad, can we get a dog?" Phil Gunstein looked from his son to the lizard, then back again. "Raygun," he said, "I think that's a great idea."
We hope that you have enjoyed our presentation of Fear, 13 Stories of Suspense and Horror, edited by R.L. Stein. Directed by Anthony Hayden Salerno, Ian Hackney, Paul Edwards, Megan Bessie, Nikki Banks Maurer, and Cliff Charles. Copyright, Welcome to the Club, copyright 2010 by R.L. Stein. She's Different Tonight, copyright 2010 by Heather Graham. Suckers, copyright 2010 by Suzanne Wayne. The Perfects, copyright 2010 by Jennifer Allison. Shadow Children, copyright 2010 by Heather Brewer. The Poison Ring, copyright 2010 by Peg Carrot. Dragonfly Eyes, copyright 2010 by Elaine Ferguson. Jeepers Peepers, copyright 2010 by Ryan Brown. Piney Power, copyright 2010 by F. Paul Wilson. The Night Hunter, copyright 2010 by Meg Cabot. Tuition, copyright 2010 by Walter Sorrells. Tagger, copyright 2010 by James Rollins. Ray Gun, copyright 2010 by Tim Malini. Performed by Peter Ganim, Joshua Swanson, Brian Kennedy, Fred Berman, Caitlin Davies, McLeod Andrews, Elena Erica Davies, Christine Havam, Eileen Stevens, Max Spector, Amanda Ronconi, Oliver Wyman, Rachel Butera, and Kevin T. Collins. Copyright in the audio recording 2010 by Audible Incorporated. All rights reserved. Published by Brilliance Audio. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. And please visit Audible at www.audible.com to discover over 50,000 titles available for download to the Apple iPod, BlackBerry, and hundreds of other MP3 players and mobile devices. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, Post Office Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.